organs, they get rid of their choirs. So you have a tiny little Reformed Baptist movement in this country of about 24 dead musicless churches.
Because if you have any wavering in your confidence about the integrity of your translation of the Bible, it'll suck the conviction right out of your heart.
And that leads to some very interesting, heretical, and very important conclusions.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. Today is Wednesday, December the 30th of 2015, the last few hours of the year 2015 are ebbing away, and 2016 is about to arrive. I wanted to record a Word Magazine today, responding to a topic, because I got a suggestion for this one from a friend that I met when I was in Hong Kong. I was in Hong Kong back in September, and preached and did some teaching at the Grace Evangelical Reformed Church there. And I met a brother there who had been reading my blog and had been listening to the Word magazines. It's kind of a strange world that we live in, isn't it? That in the internet age you can have friendships with people all over the world, and people all over the world can be listening in, and you're not aware of it. Yesterday I was talking to a brother in Oklahoma who also has been listening to the Word magazines and had some questions. We had part of our conversation was about text of Scripture, and then I was also corresponding with someone in the Netherlands yesterday. So it's a crazy world that we live in. Anyway, the friend in Hong Kong had noted that he had been reading William Hendrickson's commentary on the Gospel of Mark, and he got to the end of Mark and he was puzzled by Hendrickson's comments on the so-called longer ending of Mark, or the traditional ending of Mark, Mark 16, 9 through 20. And he noted that I think Hendrickson had made some references to Metzger. He had remembered the Word magazine that I had done on the text critic Bruce Metzger. In the end, he wrote, since Hendrickson is a much respected commentator for Reformed Christians, do you think you could comment on his writing concerning Mark's ending soon? So I think he wrote me this last week, might have been a week before last, so I hope this is soon enough. I actually responded, emailed him and told him I would try to. So anyways, today I'm getting around to it. We might begin by just, for those who don't know, giving a bit of a sketch of William Hendrickson. Who is William Hendrickson, who wrote this commentary on Mark? And by the way, on my blog, jeffriddle.net, I'm going to do a post with my notes from this Word magazine. So if you want some of the specific quotes and references, I will have a script or my notes for this episode posted there. But I'll put there a link to a biography, a short biography of Hendrickson that can be found on the Banner of Truth website. Hendrickson was born in the year 1900, died in 1982. He was a Christian Reformed minister and a Bible scholar. He was born in the Netherlands. and immigrated to the United States, to Michigan, when he was 11 years old. He went to Calvin College and Calvin Seminary and got a Ph.D. from Princeton. His book, More Than Conquerors, which offers a non-dispensational interpretation of the book of Revelation, was the first book that was published by Baker Books in the year 1940. Hendrickson is probably best known for his New Testament commentary series. You can sometimes find these at a nice discounted rate at some Christian book distributor sites. They're still widely used, widely read. He wrote the commentaries in this series for the books of Matthew through Titus, and then unfortunately passed away, and the remainder of the commentary series was completed by another Reformed New Testament scholar, Simon Kistemaker. These commentaries have become a favorite of Reformed ministers and of laymen for their generally popular tone and their generally conservative and Reformed perspective on various issues in the New Testament. He upholds things like the traditional authorship of the New Testament books, the historicity of those books. He interprets passages as reflecting, Reformed theology, Reformed soteriology. So these are, very popular books. I would say they're probably on the bookshelves of most Reformed ministers, whether they're Reformed Presbyterians, Reformed Baptists, etc. So the issue that my friend in Hong Kong is raising is, listen, this is a respected Reformed scholar. If such a respected scholar as Hendrickson didn't accept the traditional ending of Mark, why should we accept the traditional ending of Mark? I mean, this is somebody with some authority. Well, how could he come to the conclusion that Mark 16:9-20 was not original to the Gospel of Mark? So, with that bio and the basic issue having been put before us, let's turn to Hendrickson's commentary. And I actually don't have the complete set. I have various volumes, but I did have the volume on Mark. And when I preached through the Gospel of Mark a couple of years ago, I followed Hendrickson's commentary. I have a tradition, a practice, that when I'm doing an expositional sermon series through a book, I usually try to read at least two commentaries, and I usually try to choose one commentary from what I might call the old men, and then I read a more contemporary commentary, and I find there's a nice balance between the two. But when I did my sermon series through the Gospel of Mark a few years ago, Hendrickson's commentary was the more contemporary one that I read. So, Hendrickson's commentary on Mark was completed in 1975, and he gives basically verse-by-verse expositions. When you come to Mark 16:8, however, you find an excursus which has the title, The Problem with Respect to Mark 16:9-20. This is on pages 682 to 687 of the edition that I have. And it begins with the question, did Mark write verses 9-20? This is page 682. And he continues, though the Authorized Version, King James Version, of our English Bible contains them, modern translations all indicate in one way or another that there is considerable doubt about their authenticity. That statement might be generally true. It's a little bit misleading, too, because that kind of statement leads people to believe that the issue is just sort of a King James Version issue. He doesn't really address majority text, Textus Receptus, but it makes it sound as if it's just a matter of, the old King James Version and now, updating that. So it might be a little bit misleading for someone who's not familiar with the issues. So after he gives us ex cursis, this discussion of the problem of Mark 16:9-20, then for the end of the commentary, pages 687-693, he gives his various briefer notes on Mark 16:9-20. So I want to focus on the comments that he makes in this ex cursis, these five or so pages 682-687. And I give you an overview of what he says in these pages about the ending of Mark. So he begins by giving something of a little bit of a survey. And he does note those who defend the ending of Mark, including Bergen, R.C.H. Lenski, E.F. Hills. And he notes that these men vigorously defend the traditional ending. And yet, on the other hand, he sides with some others who doubt the integrity of Mark 16:9-20, and he cites along these lines N.B. Stonehouse, who in his book The Witness of Matthew and Mark to Christ, apparently someone who was Orthodox and Reformed but who rejected the authenticity of Mark 16:9-20. He might well also have cited someone like B.B. Warfield, although he doesn't cite B.B. Warfield. So he says there are two key points. First, did Mark write Mark 16:9-20? And then secondly, if you answer no to this question, does this mean that you believe that Mark was meant to end at Mark 16:8? And then he proceeds to pursue these questions. So with regard to the first question, did Mark write Mark 16:9-20? Hendrickson says no. He says explicitly, page 682, I do not believe that Mark wrote Mark 16:9-20. And he gives two basic reasons for this. First, he says he doesn't believe Mark wrote Mark 16:9-20 based on the external or the textual evidence. He says the external or textual evidence fails to support these verses. And then secondly, he says that he rejects Mark 16:9-20 as authentic based on the internal evidence. He says the internal evidence also fails to support them. His discussion of the external evidence is quite brief. And by the way, I'm gonna turn now, and I'm gonna give a sketch of what Hendrickson says about the external evidence, and I'm gonna offer a response to it, and then I'm gonna give a sketch of what he says about the internal evidence, and I'm gonna give a response to that, and then once I've done that, I'm gonna return to the question of if you reject Mark 16:9-20, does this mean Mark ends at Mark 16:8? I'm gonna give Hendrickson's overview of that. But let's start off with what he says about the external evidence. Hendrickson notes that Mark 16:9-20 is missing in the Codices Vaticanus and Sinaiticus. He also notes that it's missing in the Old Latin Codex K or Codex Babiensis, that it's not in the Sinaitic Syriac version. And he adds on page 683 that it's also missing in other very early manuscripts. That statement is a bit misleading because it's really not missing in very many other early, very early manuscripts. Anyway, I'm jumping ahead to the response, and I don't want to do that. Let me back up and continue to survey what he says. He adds that Clement of Alexandria and Origen, two church fathers, quote, seem not to have known these verses, end quote, page 683. He also cites Eusebius and Jerome as saying that the traditional ending was missing in early manuscripts. So, again, it's just this, his survey of the external evidence is literally just two paragraphs. So it's very short. It's a very short, very brief sketch. So let me respond to these arguments. We might begin by making the observation that Hendrickson, although he cites the fact that Mark 16, 9 through 20 is missing in Codex Vaticanus and Codex Sinaiticus, he fails to discuss the positive evidence for the traditional ending. And by the way, I've said before in these podcasts that I think the ending of Mark is really a slam dunk for the traditional text. I really don't understand how it has come to be so highly doubted among Reformed evangelical traditional Christians. Sinaiticus and Vaticanus are the only Greek manuscripts that omit Mark 16, 9 through 20. And again, the positive evidence, which Hendrickson doesn't address at all, in my view, is overwhelming. The traditional ending is found in Codex Alexandrinus, which is also very early, on par with Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. By the way, he also doesn't mention the fact that both Sinaiticus and Vaticanus have odd blank spaces in the columns where they end at Mark 16:8, as if either it was going to be added at a later point, or acknowledging that a longer ending was known. In previous blog posts that I've done at jeffriddle.net, I have printed images of the ending of Codex Sinaiticus, Codex Vaticanus, and I'll see if I can put a link, and you can view those as well. It's also the traditional ending is in Codex C, which is also known as Codex Ephraemi Rescripti, which is also dated to the 5th century. It is also found in Codex D, which is known as Codex Beza, which likewise dates to the 5th or the 6th century, as well as the fact that it appears in the vast majority of extant manuscripts. We're talking about over 1,000 manuscripts. I know that the typical view is to say that manuscripts should be weighed and not merely counted, but both on the basis of weighing and counting, it's in the vast majority, it's in very ancient Greek manuscripts, and so I think that tilts the balance in favor of its authenticity. Hendrickson also fails to mention that the longer ending of Mark is cited in the early church fathers, including in the writings of Justin Martyr, and most significantly in the writings of Irenaeus of Lyon, 2nd century, in his writing against heresies, chapter 3, paragraph 10, verse 5. There is an explicit citation of Mark 16:19, which records the ascension of Jesus, and also an explicit reference to the fact that he is citing the ending of Mark's gospel. So I think the external evidence, in my view, is overwhelmingly in favor of the authenticity of the longer ending of Mark. Another respected Reformed Dutch scholar reached a very different conclusion given the same evidence. This is Jacob van Bruggen in his book, The Future of the Bible, Thomas Nelson, 1978, page 131. He said, there are only three known Greek manuscripts that end at 16:8, and one of them has a large open space after verse 8. All the remaining Greek manuscripts contain verses 9 through 20 after Mark 16, 1 through 8, and most of them do not have a single note or insertion of other data. Mark 16, 1 through 20 has both the authority of the majority text as well as the authority of the oldest text. If it still remains uncertain whether Mark 16, 9 through 20 is well attested textually, then very little of any of the texts of the New Testament is well attested, end quote. So if you want to do dueling Dutch New Testament scholars, you can put William Hendrickson on one side, but you can put Jacob van Bruggen on the other. As for the Eusebius and the Jerome comments, I've mentioned this before. You should go and read Dean John Bergen's book, The Last 12 Verses of Mark, reprinted by Sovereign Grace Publishers, 2000, and look at chapter 5, pages 116 to 147. It has the title, The Alleged Hostile Witness of Certain Early Church Fathers Proved to Be an Imagination of the Critics. There, Bergen discusses a number of things. For one thing, he mentions the anecdote about Clement of Alexandria that Hendrickson perpetuates. Well, Clement of Alexandria seems not to know the longer ending of Mark. He makes a very interesting point, page 117. Bergen says, well, Clement of Alexandria also never explicitly cites anything from Matthew 28. But no one runs around saying Matthew 28 is an original to the first gospel because Clement of Alexandria doesn't cite it. The fact that Clement of Alexandria doesn't cite anything from Mark 16 no more proves that Mark 16 is inauthentic than the fact that he doesn't quote anything from Matthew 28 proves that that Matthew 28 isn't authentic to the ending of Matthew. But more importantly are the comments that Bergen makes about Eusebius and Jerome. And you should read his comments there, particularly pages 119 to 129, what he has to say about the Eusebius reference, and pages 129 to 135, what he says about the references to Jerome. I've pulled my copy of Bergen's The Last 12 Verses of Mark. Let me just read here a couple of things that he explicitly says toward the end of the discussion. This is on page 144. He says, I profess myself unable to understand how it can be pretended that Eusebius would have subscribed to the opinion of Tischendorf, Tregelis, and the rest that the Gospel of St. Mark was never finished by its inspired author or was mutilated before it came abroad. At all events, that the last 12 verses are spurious. And then with regard to Jerome, page 145, Bergen says, individually, however, it is certain that Jerome was convinced of the genuineness of St. Mark 16, 9 through 20, for in two different places of his writings, he not only quotes the 9th and 14th verses, but he exhibits all the 12 in the Vulgate. So, if you read Bergen, he says that the comment from Jerome about him knowing manuscripts that are missing the ending of Mark 16, 9 through 20, he believes it's actually simply Jerome passing on what Eusebius had cited. But then he says, look, the proof is in the pudding. When Jerome did the Vulgate, he included Mark 16, 9 through 20. So that should settle the issue as to what Jerome's final opinion was about the traditional ending of Mark. So that's a summary of Hendrickson on the external evidence, and that's my brief response. Let's turn now to the issue of internal evidence. What does Hendrickson say in his commentary about internal evidence? He makes three arguments based largely on comparing Mark 16, 1 through 8, which he holds to be authentic, and Mark 16, 9 through 20. The three arguments are first relating to diction, or basically vocabulary. And when he makes this comparison, he says that there are, in verses 1 through 8, only four words that are unique to Mark, that are hapax legomena, words that only appear once. So there are four hapax legomena words that appear in verses 1 through 8, but there are 14 words that appear in verses 9 through 20. And so the argument would go because there are more words that are unique to Mark in verses 9 through 20, then this proves that it wasn't from the original hand of Mark. Secondly, based on style. He focuses on the Greek conjunction chi, normally translated simply as and. And he says in verses 1 through 8, it appears 8 times, or about once per verse. Whereas in verses 9 through 20, it only appears 6 or 7 times, so only about once every 2 verses. And so based on that, he says verses 9 through 20 is not authentic. And then thirdly, content, diction, style, and content. Here he focuses, and again, it's a rather brief discussion, but he focuses on the fact that in verse 7, Mark 16:7, what he assumes to be authentic, the young man who appears to the women at the resurrection of Jesus tells them to tell the disciples that Jesus will appear to them in Galilee. And then he says, though, in verses 9 through 20, there are appearances of Jesus that are recorded, but there is no explicit mention of these appearances taking place in Galilee. And so he sees a disjunction here that supposedly proves that Mark 16, 9 through 20 is inauthentic. I'm not going to go into as much detail in offering my response. I would just simply observe that arguments that are based on style, arguments based on internal evidence, evaluation of internal evidence, are notoriously difficult to prove because they usually involve subjective judgments based on limited evidence. And I think Hendrickson's discussion on style is particularly demonstrative of this point. They're weak because he only compares a limited number of verses. He compares verses 1 through 8, which he assumes to be authentically Markan, with verses 9 through 20. So he compares 8 verses with 12 verses. The weakness of this approach is he makes no comparisons with passages of similar length in other sections of Mark. So he doesn't compare the vocabulary and style of verses 1 through 8 with verses 9 through 20 with something in chapter 1, something in chapter 2, something in chapter 8, something in chapter 14. And so, again, this weakens his argument. With regard to diction or vocabulary, it seems to me that Mark 16, 9 through 20 exhibits the normal variety found in other passages of similar length in Mark. And to prove this, I would point you in the direction of Maurice Robinson's analysis of this. And Maurice Robinson, we've referred to her a number of times in Word magazines. He's an advocate, not for the position I have for the confessional text, but he's an advocate of the majority text. But he certainly is a formidable proponent for the traditional ending of Mark. And he wrote a chapter in a book that was edited by David Allen Black called Perspectives on the Ending of Mark, published by Broadman and Holman in 2008, came out of a symposium that was held at Southeastern Seminary. And his chapter in that book is titled The Long Ending of Mark as Canonical Verity, pages 40 through 79. It comes just after Dan Wallace's chapter that argues that Mark 16, 9 through 20 is not authentic and that Mark ought to end at Mark 16, 8. But Robinson's book covers not only the external evidence, but he particularly gives a nice discussion of the internal evidence. And I would point you in particular to pages 65 and 66 on vocabulary-related considerations, where he notes several studies, including one by the 19th century scholar John Broadus, who compared the 12 verses in the longer ending, Mark 16, 9 through 20, with not 16, 1 through 8, but 15, 44 through 16, 8. And also John Bergen's comparison of Mark 1, 1 through 12, with Mark 16:9-20. And then also he refers to a study by Bruce Terry, who examined Mark 15:40-16:4 with Mark 16:9-20. All of these found that the vocabulary usage in Mark 16:9-20 is not inconsistent with the vocabulary usage in the rest of Mark's gospel. With regard to style, and in particular the use of the conjunction chi, I would point you to the Nicholas Lunn book, which appeared in 2014, which I'll make a reference to later in the podcast. The book is called The Original Ending of Mark, and he has a discussion in particular on the use of the conjunction chi and also the use of the conjunction de within Mark 16:9-20. And he reaches a very different conclusion than William Hendrickson. If you look at his study, Lund's study on pages 159-160, you'll find that he comes to the conclusion that the usage of chi in Mark 16:9-20 is not inconsistent with the usage of the conjunction chi throughout the rest of the gospel. In fact, he concludes on page 160, we conclude that the particular usage and frequency of de, the conjunction de, in the longer ending, as well as its proportion relative to chi, does not constitute a decisive argument against its Markan origin. So here is another credentialed scholar coming to a very different conclusion based on his analysis of the style of Mark 16:9-20. With regard, finally, to content, the Galilee argument is particularly weak. There is no explicit reference to Galilee in Mark 16:9-20, but that doesn't mean that Galilee was not the setting for some of the appearances recorded in Mark 16:9-20, nor does it mean that those are not fulfillments of what was explicitly said in Mark 16:7. So when it comes to the internal evidence, so-called, again, it's far from a slam dunk for Hendrickson. In fact, I believe an honest assessment of the evidence actually shows that the internal evidence supports the consistency of Mark 16:9-20 with the rest of the style and vocabulary that we find throughout the Gospel of Mark. Well, Hendrickson, after talking about external internal evidence and noting that he rejects Mark 16:9-20, he turns to the second question. If you reject Mark 16:9-20 as not being original, does this mean that you believe that that one should believe that Mark ended at Mark 16:8? And to Hendrickson's credit, his discussion here is quite interesting because he says no. He does not believe that Mark ended at Mark 16:8. It's particularly interesting because he interacts with people who sort of want to read Mark as being like a modern work. This is sort of the reading that Dan Wallace gives to the ending of Mark, that it has sort of this postmodern vibe to it. It's very dramatic that it ends with the women going away afraid and not telling anyone. Hendrickson says on page 686, the day of modern fiction writing had not yet arrived. Today, in certain literary circles, the fashion is to create an agonizing drama that leaves the reader hanging breathlessly at the edge of a cliff, wondering how things are going to turn out. Suddenly, the story ends, minus any real denouement. Does Mark do something similar? In the end, however, he rejects that as being a sort of an anachronistic reading of Mark. And by the way, Hendrickson's commentary was written in the 70s. He's not literally interacting with Dan Wallace. I'm making that comparison. I'm comparing Hendrickson's rejection of the idea that Mark ended at Mark 16:8 with Dan Wallace's more recent articulation of that. Not that Hendrickson was interacting with Wallace, because Wallace doesn't begin writing till some decades later. But anyway, we've got Hendrickson in a pickle. He doesn't believe Mark 16:9 through 20 is original, but he also doesn't believe that Mark originally meant to end his gospel at Mark 16:8. And so the conclusion we have to come to is Hendrickson believes there was some other ending which has apparently been lost, and we no longer have it. Hendrickson sort of pleads the fifth, however, in the commentary, in that he does not ever offer any concrete suggestion for what happened to the real ending of Mark, nor does he really deal with the sort of theological problems that would come about with regard to the doctrine of preservation if the inspired ending of Mark was lost. In fact, he says at the end of his comments on page 687, he says, "I have no desire to add to the confusion." I would respectfully say, though, that by rejecting Mark 16:9 through 20, he has necessarily added to the confusion. He also notes on page 687 that no sermon, doctrine, or practice should be based solely upon its content. So he doesn't think that a sermon should be based solely on anything in Mark 16:9 through 20. I mean, on one hand, I hear what he's saying. I don't think any sermon or any doctrine should be based on any single passage. We should use the whole counsel of God. We should use all of Scripture to support our doctrine, and we might even say any sermon. But I would strongly disagree with him if what he means by that is that we shouldn't ever preach a sermon from Mark 16:9 through 20. In this regard, Hendrickson seems to be on the same side as John MacArthur, who likewise says that we shouldn't preach from Mark 16:9 through 20, or probably somebody like John Piper, who said we shouldn't preach sermons from the woman caught in adultery. In this regard, if you want to see my responses to what some have said about whether we can preach from Mark 16:9 through 20, I would call your attention to Word Magazine number 4, where I dealt with MacArthur and his handling of Mark's ending, or Word Magazine number 35, where the theme was, "Can we preach the ending of Mark?" And I'll put links to those on the blog post at jeffriddle.net, and also Word Magazine number 36 on the ending of Mark, cessationism, and apologetics. So that is my analysis of Hendrickson. Let's turn now to some final thoughts on this topic. So let's return to the original issue, the original question. If such a respected scholar as William Hendrickson, whose commentaries are on the shelves of just about every Reformed minister, Presbyterian or Baptist, if such a respected scholar did not accept the traditional ending of Mark, why should we? If somebody so learned and who knows, more than we do, rejected the ending of Mark, isn't that a pretty strong argument in favor of rejecting the Gospel of Mark? There's sort of with regard to logic, it's an appeal to authority. If such an authority rejects Mark, shouldn't I? Well, I would just respond respectfully by saying that although I think there might be many good things about William Hendrickson's commentaries, and I've appreciated his work. I've read More Than Conquerors, for example, and his analysis of Revelation. I've already said his commentary on Mark and other commentaries he's written. But I would say respectfully, however, that I think he was wrong on the matter of the text of Scripture. And actually, his scholarship in this regard reflects that of many men of his generation who were, doing their theological education in places like Princeton Seminary in the middle of the 20th century. This doesn't mean that his commentaries aren't useful, but it does mean that they should be read with discernment and they should be read with caution. Again, Hendrickson was like many other Reformed and even conservative evangelicals of the mid-20th century. They tended to be deeply influenced by the currents of the modern historical critical method, particularly with regard to the text of Scripture. Along these lines, I would recommend a book, if you haven't read it yet, by Ian Murray, a book published in the year 2000 with the title Evangelicalism Divided, A Record of Crucial Changes in the Years 1950 to 2000. And in particular, he has a chapter in there, it's the seventh chapter, pages 173 to 214, titled Intellectual Respectability and Scripture. And in that chapter, Murray is primarily talking about evangelicalism in the United Kingdom, but he's talking about how many young conservative men went to the major British universities because they wanted to get PhDs in biblical studies and they wanted intellectual respectability, but they were going to do this without compromising their commitment to the inerrancy or infallibility of Scripture. But then sadly, he notes that many of them in doing so eventually had to compromise their high view of the authority of Scripture. And he mentions men like F.F. Bruce and Alistair McGrath and others. And it's a very interesting chapter. I would commend it to you. As part of that discussion, at one point he says, Murray does, the academic approach to Scripture treats the divine element for all practical purposes as non-existent. History shows that when evangelicals allow that approach, their teaching will sooner or later begin to look a little different from that of liberals. That's on page 185 of Evangelicalism Divided. I actually did a review of this book several years ago. I'll see if I can find that and put it on Google Docs, and you can read that as well. Now, Murray wasn't talking about Hendrickson, and I'm guessing he probably has a pretty high view of Hendrickson, given that there's an author bio on Banner of Truth. He was, again, talking more about F.F. Bruce, Alistair McGrath, and others. But what he says about F.F. Bruce can also be applied to Hendrickson when it comes to Hendrickson's embrace of the modern historical critical mainstream academic approach to the text of Scripture and the embrace in particular of the modern critical text over against the confessional text or the traditional text. In general, we just might say that, read the contemporary men, even men who are supposed to be conservative like Hendrickson. Read them with caution, read them with discernment, but also, best to rely on the older commentators. Read Calvin, read Matthew Henry, read Matthew Poole, read Charles Spurgeon. Read them with discernment also, but particularly with regard to text, you're going to find more of a commitment to the traditional text in those older men than you're going to find in contemporary men. But we shouldn't be dispirited by this. So I'll say to my friend in Hong Kong, don't be dispirited by this. On the contrary, I think there are some very encouraging signs on the horizon. There is something of a small movement. There are people beginning to question the embrace of the modern critical text. And as one evidence of that, I just got an email today from a friend who was pointing out to me a recent blog post that was put up on the Ligonier Ministry site by Keith Matheson. And he was mentioning several books he had read in 2015, and one of those that he mentions is Nicholas Lund's book on the original ending of Mark, subtitled A New Case for the Authenticity of Mark 16, 9 through 20. And in that little notice, Matheson said the following. He said, this may have been the most surprising book I read in 2015, talking about Lund's book, Defending the Traditional Ending of Mark. He continues, my thoughts on the ending of Mark have been basically settled for over 20 years. I have long been convinced that the original ending of Mark was at 16:8. Lund's book has caused me to go back and take another look at the evidence and seriously reconsider my position. He provides a very thorough and helpful examination of the external and internal evidence. His consideration of the linguistic argument is particularly good. In my opinion, Lund's book demonstrates that the case for the longer ending of Mark is a lot stronger than many of us have been led to believe. And he certainly demonstrates that the case for the shorter ending is a lot weaker. It will be interesting to see whether his work reopens the debate and changes any minds. That's the end of the quote. And I'll put a link to that blog post as well from Keith Matheson. Well, that's very encouraging. And we can only hope that this trend will continue, that other people will begin to rethink, the position of Hendrickson and others on the ending of Mark. And maybe they'll even begin to rethink the modern critical text position on other passages, on the doxology in the Lord's Prayer in Mark 6, on Jesus' words from the cross in Luke 23, on the woman caught in adultery passage, John 7:53-8:11. And dare we hope that there might even be those who would rethink the wisdom of rejecting the Ethiopian eunuch's confession of faith, that is baptism, Mark 8:37, or even, now we're really getting very hopeful, even the Coma Johannaeum. Is it possible that these passages that were rejected, that there ought to be a reconsideration of them? Well, Mark 16:9-20 is an easier place to begin, and I am thankful, appreciative of my friend in Hong Kong having some questions and wanting some clarification on Hendrickson's position, and I hope this is helpful, has been helpful to him, and I hope that it will be helpful to others who are sort of overhearing the dialogue that he and I are having about this. And again, hope this episode is helpful to you. This will probably be the last one for 2015. Hopefully we will have some future Word magazines that will come down the pike in the new year in 2016, God willing. Till then, take care and God bless.
Doings, Lord, how deep your thoughts be.